Welcome to Blue Fire's podcast, where we entertain you with tales of famous people you've never heard of. Each week, Steve, Lottie or Linda will guide you through the centuries to shine the spotlight once again on entertainers that history has forgotten. Join us for drama, interviews and the occasional chat over a bottle of wine as we discover that the topics of plague, poverty and overnight stardom are not unique to the 21st century. And today's podcast episode is all about Elizabeth Robbins, actress, writer, suffragette, many, many other things. And we are delighted that we have the lovely Dr. Renata Colbertz-Miller to talk to us about her. Renata is a professor of English and also deputy dean of humanities and the arts at the City College of New York. She is a native New Yorker. So welcome, Renata. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
So it's lovely of you to join us. Thank you so much. Now, you and I kind of met across the footlights at the Victoria and Albert Museum when you did a lecture based on your current book in which Elizabeth Robbins features. So this is rather a nice little extension, really. So can you tell us a little bit about why you like Elizabeth Robbins in this particular period?
Well, my book, which is called The Victorian Actress in the Novel and on the Stage, begins in the 1830s and ends in the 19-teens. And it looks at how the Victorian novels and plays use the actress, who is a significant figure for the relationship between women and the public sphere, to define their own place within and among genres and in relationship to their audiences, whether they were reading audiences or audiences in a theater. So the book traces a cultural history of the actress that led actresses to appropriate the pen for themselves by becoming suffragette playwrights and writing new social roles for women. And Elizabeth Robbins was one of the women who did that. I'm also attracted to Elizabeth Robbins because she strikes me as a problem solver. She's someone who developed new abilities and worked in different modes to bring about change, to solve problems that she saw. And given the fact that she's an American who felt such an attraction to London and its culture, as an American myself who studies British literature and theater, I think I feel some kinship with her.
I love to hear you think that you've got some kinship with her as well. You kind of get to know these people, don't you? So without further ado, I'm going to leave you and Renata's going to tell us all about wonderful Ms. Robbins.
Elizabeth Robbins was an actress, a producer, a novelist, a memoirist, a playwright, and a suffragette. This extraordinary list of roles results from her living a dynamic life, moving into new areas of activity in order to effect change. In her collection of writings on the suffragette movement, Way Stations, Robbins begins with an author's note in which she says that her appearances in print or on platforms have each and all been the direct result of some special call or crisis. Both her creative output and her life itself reveals much about women playing roles in the public world. As Robbins moved through these different modes of engaging with the world, she crossed paths and had meaningful relationships with a number of significant cultural figures. In the next half hour, I'll talk about the various phases of Robbins' career, focusing on her transition from actress to playwright, and on the cultural and social contributions she made. I should begin by explaining that Elizabeth Robbins spelled her name R-O-B-I-N-S, which is distinct from another Elizabeth Robbins who spelled her last name with two B's. Our Elizabeth Robbins was born in 1862 in Louisville, Kentucky. She grew up in Zanesville, Ohio, in central Ohio with rolling hills, in a house known as the Old Stone House, which was believed to be a stop on the Underground Railroad. She became an actress and acted both for Edwin Booth Theater and the Boston Museum Company. She married an actor named George Parks. But her life in the United States came to a dramatic change when George Parks killed himself by throwing himself into Boston's Charles River wearing a full suit of theatrical armor. Elizabeth needed a change, and she decided to move to London. She describes her struggle to establish herself in London and to get roles as an actress in her memoir, Both Sides of the Curtain, in which she recounts her relationships with Herbert Beerbohm Tree, Oscar Wilde, Henry James, Ellen Terry, and other prominent members of the theater community. She also talks about the limits and dangers that actresses face and the frustrations that she confronted. One of these frustrations had to do with the social place of the actress, which she describes as being akin to prostitutes. She writes in Both Sides of the Curtain, "As an actress, it seems likely I exacted a show of respect that I would not have insisted on or bothered about had I never gone on the stage. It is only so that I can understand the passages, and there are many, when I snubbed people from what might have been innocent friendliness and refused many a pleasure that I could have seized simply, gratefully, gaily, had I not been of the profession, still liable to be confused with that one oldest in the world." And she talks in Both Sides of the Curtain about the struggles against men who wanted to keep her as a mistress as she pursued a more serious professional direction. And another example of the challenges that she, or her frustrations that she faced, were in the sexism that she confronted in the theater. She describes an exchange that she had with the renowned theater manager Henry Irving of the Lyceum Theater. She says, "Yes, of that I'm convinced. I am a little concerned at the prospect of playing for so long a part out of my line," describing a role that she was playing. "Women don't seem to do that with the success men do. An actor plays an old man one week and a young hero the next and wins success in both. But if a woman makes success in an old part, she is relegated to them alone. It's very hard." Irving responded, "Ah, but women have an easy road to travel on the stage. They have but to appear, and their sweet feminine charm wins the battle." Robbins reflects, "I had thought we were talking about acting. Hurriedly, I readjust myself. With some, maybe. There are others who don't find it so easy." Irving replied, "I'm quite sure you do." Robbins reflected on this incident. "So much more happens to us than we realize at the time of happening. The brief passage with Henry Irving added gently to the general pressure that would confine women of the stage to the old province outside the stage. The rare exceptions, the great actresses, some of them had escaped, with the result that lesser women or less fortunate had been misled. What was wanted of the women of the stage was, first and mainly, what was wanted of the women outside, a knack of pleasing. Much as I myself loved pleasing, and more than most, it didn't seem enough. Besides, where did it get you, outside the purely sexual limit?" Something that helped to sustain Robbins during this time was her friendship with Henry James. Robbins met her fellow American expatriate in January 1891, the year after The Tragic Muse was published, and she performed in his own adaptation of his novel, The American. Angela V. John describes James's 1892 short story, Nona Vincent, as thinly disguised Jamesian representations of Florence Bell and Elizabeth Robbins. Florence Bell was a friend of Robbins who would later become a collaborator of hers. And this comparison makes Robbins the young actress struggling to please a playwright in the short story. Theater and Friendship, a collection of letters from James to Robbins, documents what Elizabeth described as a friendship that made itself at home in the haunts of Adelphi melodrama and made James welcome with an ardor that astonished even Robbins, a play devoted to justification of militant woman suffrage. In other words, The sustained connection between James and Robbins traces the transition from Robbins as an actress struggling to play roles in the Victorian theatre, both literally as an actress playing a part on stage and figuratively as an actress with a rich cultural legacy scripting her place in society, to Robbins as a playwright who reworks both theatrical conventions and the ways in which actresses and women participated in the public sphere. A critical part of this transition for Robbins was her involvement in the performances of Henrik Ibsen. And James was a great supporter of Robbins as she took on Ibsen roles as an actress. On Robbins' 1891 production of Hedda Gabler, James wrote that Ibsen is destined to be adored by, quote, the profession. And by profession, he meant the actor and actress. He cuts them out work to which the artistic nature in them joyously responds, work difficult and interesting, full of stuff and opportunity. The opportunity that he gives them is almost always to do the deep and delicate thing, the sort of chance that, in proportion as they are intelligent, they are most on the lookout for. He asks them to paint with a fine brush, for the subject that he gives them is ever our plastic humanity. Robbins similarly believed that Ibsen's power was in creating new theatrical roles for actresses, and she stated in her lecture, Ibsen and the Actress, "Ibsen had taught us something we were never to unlearn. The lesson had nothing to do with the new woman. It had everything to do with our own particular business, with the art of acting. Events, after Hedda, emphasized for us the kinds of life that stretched in front of the women condemned to the hackwork of the stage. That was what we called playing even the best parts in plays selected by the actor-manager." But Robbins didn't only act in Ibsen's plays. She took the stage as Hedda after forming a joint management company in 1891 with fellow actress Marion Lee. These two actresses were responsible for bringing Hedda Gabler to the British stage. There's a wonderful photo of Elizabeth Robbins in this role of Hedda, in which she's wearing a black feather boa. And the photo is taken during the scene in which she is burning her friend Thea's manuscript. She talks about how she's burning Thea's book, she's burning Thea's baby. I mean, she's wearing this very dramatic black feather boa as she's leaning in toward the fire to do this. And I want you to keep that image in your mind as I read you a part of a review of how other people responded to Elizabeth Robbins in this role. In the same way that Robbins saw power in Ibsen, so too did theatrical reviewers see power in Ibsen, although perhaps not in the same positive terms that Elizabeth viewed Ibsen. So one reviewer wrote, "Miss Elizabeth Robbins approached her task with artistic glee and crowned it with undoubted success. The lovers of sustained art should not miss it, even if the play itself shocks them. The character grew under the influence of the actress. Her face was a study. No one could move their eyes from her. It was the morbid attraction that we have felt at the central criminal court at a great murder trial. What changes of expression and of manner! What watchfulness! What a sublime study of deceit and heartlessness! It is said there are such women in the world. There may be, but thank God they are the rare exception, not the rule. And Miss Elizabeth Robbins has done what no doubt she fully intended to do. She has made vice attractive by her art. She has almost ennobled crime. She has stopped the shudder that so repulsive a creature should have inspired. She has glorified an unwomanly woman. She has made a heroine out of a sublimated sinner. She has fascinated us with a savage." These unconventional female roles that Robbins found in Ibsen were a critical transitional step for her. She credits the stage with having given Ibsen a platform, but she also credits Ibsen with having changed theater. She wrote, "Without the help of the stage, the world would not have had an Ibsen to celebrate, and without Ibsen, the world would not have had the stage as it became after his plays were acted." She describes the London production of A Doll's House in 1889 as an event that was to change lives and literatures, and the importance to her own self-respect of playing the role of Mrs. Linda in a later production. According to Robbins, Ibsen was justifying what some of us, with very little encouragement, had blindly believed about the profession of acting. Ibsen provided an illustrative example of something that Robbins would herself develop in her political drama. In Robbins's view, the domestic drama of Hedda Gabler has a significance that transcends the particular. She wrote, "Ibsen not only knew better, he saw further than the special instance. He saw what we at the time did not. I mean the general bearing of Hedda's story." Hedda epitomizes the claustrophobia of women confined to the domestic sphere, and Robbins had earlier, despite her desperation for work upon first settling in London, turned down traditional female domestic roles. According to Robbins, no dramatist has ever meant so much to the women of the stage as Henrik Ibsen, not only for the roles that he created, but for the roles that his writing made possible. Robbins herself would later develop a realistic theater that moved beyond the confines of domestic drama. A partner of Robbins, both professionally and romantically, as she worked on Ibsen, was the prominent theater critic and Ibsen translator William Archer. Archer was a married man, and there is speculation by at least one Robbins biographer that Robbins became pregnant with Archer's baby and had an abortion. Both Robbins and Archer became involved in J.T. Grein's Independent Theater Society, a private subscription theater that was, as George Bernard Shaw described it, independent of commercial success. The Independent Theater sought to redress what critics identified as the commercial and, in turn, artistic limitations of the theater. Ibsen's plays would serve as foundational and touchstone productions for the Theater Society. It would also produce Robbins's first attempt at playwriting. Allen's Wife, which she wrote with Florence Bell, was based on Ellen Amin's Swedish story, Befriad. In a pivotal moment in her career, Robbins surrendered the part of the title role in Arthur Wing Pinero's The Second Mrs. Tanqueray to Stella Campbell, Pinero's first choice for the role, who had arranged to be released from another contract. The role of a courtesan who kills herself because she cannot conceal her sexual fallenness, despite having married into respectable and genteel society. Paula Tanqueray made the fame of Campbell after the play opened on May 27, 1893 at the St. James Theatre. Robbins, meanwhile, took on initiatives developing roles for women that broke the mold of the society drama and the fallen woman. Instead of acting the role of Stella Campbell, she engaged in a project that would build on Ibsen's representation of women's experience within society and would continue to move her towards becoming a key figure in the Actresses Franchise League. In Allen's Wife, she herself performed the path-breaking female part when it was produced on the afternoon of April 28th and the evening of May 2nd at Terry's Theatre by the Independent Theatre Society, even as she and Florence Bell kept their authorship a secret. When Elizabeth met with J.T. Grein on December 30th, 1892, she read him a play adaptation of Amin's short story. The play was Allen's Wife. As Grein's wife would later write, "Her exquisite delivery and the poignant emotion of the piece had a great effect upon J.T. He afterwards admitted that he had not heard a play, but lived it and suffered with the wretched heroine. All he could say to the reader was, 'We shall do that play. We will produce it as soon as we can. It is a beautiful tragedy.'" In a subsequent meeting, he asked Robbins about the play's authorship. And as Grein's wife wrote, "Her reply was that the author did not wish his name divulged, and she extracted a promise from J.T. not to endeavor to ascertain in any way the identity of the writer." And so, as Robbins rehearsed under the direction of Grein's autocratic stage manager, Herman Dallange, no one was aware that she and her friend, Lady Florence Bell, were the authors of this bold play. Grein will only learn of this from Florence Bell 30 years later. But Robbins was acting a role one that she herself had had a hand in writing, that broke the mold of melodramatic conventions, even as it consciously employed some of them, but with a difference. The central role of Jean Creek, or Alan's wife, evokes Victorian melodrama's cherished beliefs about the sanctity of motherhood, but redefines them grimly in a play that demonstrates the conflict between idealized gender roles and the realities of industrial society. The first scene opens with Jean as a new bride, pregnant and brimming with pride about the physical strength of her husband, Alan. But scene one ends with Alan returning from his factory job, not striding confidently home to embrace his wife, but as a lifeless corpse on a stretcher. When Jean's baby is subsequently born deformed, she fears for its ability to fend for itself in a society that shows no mercy for the weak, and scene two closes with Jean moving toward the child's cradle to smother it. The third and final scene is Jean's tour de force. As she is questioned about her crime, she refuses to answer, remaining silent and communicating only through gesture. Despite her mother's urging, she refuses the defense of puerperal insanity, which is what the Victorians called what we would now call postpartum depression, and she is sentenced to death. Her dramatic power lies in her silence, which bespeaks the problems of representing her experience within the society that the play represents. This legal scene echoes the trial scene that appears in many Victorian melodramas. But unlike melodrama, in which the trial, or the revelation that follows the trial, visibly enacts justice, Alan's wife employs this silence trial scene to criticize a society in which justice is impossible for Jean's experience. On the other hand, as it rejects stage dialogue, Bell and Robbins draw on and develop the melodramatic convention of physical emotional gesture standing for authentic feeling. The scene relies on the effect that Jean will be viewed as authentic because her emotional gestures are truer than spoken words. By dramatizing the impossibility of representing Jean's experience to her audience within the play in speech, Alan's wife demonstrates an uncertainty about women's ability to gain a voice in the public world at the same time that it attempts a public theatrical representation of a crisis in a woman's life. Just as reviews of Ibsen were shocked by the new material that Ibsen presented, reviewers were shocked by Alan's wife. A review of the play in the Illustrated Sporting and Dramatic News argued that the play deals with matters wholly unsuited to the traffic of the stage, that in its dramatic methods it is crude and even barbaric, and that it is wholly lacking in the taste and instinct needed for the accomplishment of all sound artistic work. The review even took issue with Jean's hopeful talk with her mother about her unborn child, a kind of conversation which the average playgoer feels it indiscreet to hear. A.B. Walkley's review in The Speaker was so disturbed by the subject matter that it invented grisly details, remonstrating about the tastelessness of the mangled corpse and dead baby that never appeared on stage, as Archer pointed out in a detailed rebuttal that was part of his preface to the published version of the play. In the 1890s, Robbins began to write long-format fiction and nonfiction. Her first work in this area was a novel called George Mandeville's Husband, which was published in 1894. George Mandeville's Husband really is a response on Robbins' part to attacks on the stage, particularly by the novelist George Moore. George Moore had written an essay called Mummer Worship and a novel in 1885 called Mummer's Wife, in which he asserted that the theater and respectable society should not mingle. And he particularly uses actresses as an example of why these two worlds cannot meet. George Mandeville's Husband is a response to that because it satirizes attacks on the theater and attacks on women who perform in the public world. Robbins wrote this novel and others under the non-gendered pen name C.E. Raymond, R-A-I-M-O-N-D, despite the fact that the publisher of her early novels, William Heinemann, pressured her to parlay her theatrical fame into book sales by writing under her own name. Robbins's pen name was an homage of sorts to her brother, Raymond Robbins, who would go on to become an important labor leader in the United States, and who married Margaret Dreyer, who was herself an important figure in the labor movement. Raymond also plays an important role in Robbins's life in the 1890s and in her writings, because she went to rescue him from Alaska, where he had become ill while on a trip. Elizabeth's adventures in Alaska figure in both her fiction and her nonfiction, in books such as The Magnetic North and Come and Find Me. During this period, Elizabeth also bought a home near Brooksville, Florida, which she believed she would share with her brother Raymond. She called it Chinsegut, the Eskimo word for the recovery of lost things. It still stands today, and you can visit it. It's Chinsegut Hill Historic Site. It's a beautiful home up on a hilltop with two-story verandas and long views of the surrounding countryside. But the house didn't provide the sense of family and solace that Elizabeth had hoped for. Her relationship with her brother Raymond and his wife Margaret Dreyer Robbins was strained, and so Elizabeth ended up spending much less time there than she expected. It was primarily a home for Raymond and his wife. Robbins turned her hands to writing for the women's suffrage movement in England. She became president of the Women Writers' Suffrage League, and she wrote her suffrage drama Votes for Women under the auspices of the Actresses Franchise League, a multi-hundred-member organization that developed its own play department, as actresses such as Cicely Hamilton, Inez Bensusan, and Gertrude Jennings turned their hands to playwriting in order to use the theater for the suffrage movement. The Actresses Franchise League defined its goals as being, one, to convince members of the theatrical profession of the necessity of extending the franchise to women, two, to work for women's enfranchisement by educational methods such as propaganda meetings, sale of literature, propaganda plays, and lectures, and three, to assist all other leagues whenever possible. In contrast to the silence of Ellen's wife, Robbins's play Votes for Women is about women expressing themselves in the theater and in the political sphere. Robbins's novel, The Convert, which she wrote because she was afraid that Votes for Women might never be staged, appeared in October 1907, between the production and subsequent publication of her play. In both the play and the novel, the dynamic and stylish suffragette Vida Levering gains the sympathy of a younger woman, Jean Dunbarton. Jean is engaged to marry Jeffrey Stoner, a prominent conservative member of parliament who suddenly finds his re-election threatened by the liberal candidate. Jeffrey is also Vida's former lover, whom she left because she was unable to forgive him after concealing and aborting her pregnancy at his urging. Jean feels that Jeffrey must make amends by offering to marry Vida. Vida sees in Jean an opportunity to gain Jeffrey's support for women's suffrage. Although the play Votes for Women does not narrate Jean's conversion with the omniscience of the novel, meaning it doesn't have a narrative perspective that gets you inside characters' heads, the process of conversion is its crux. The play focuses on how a woman can convert an onstage audience through her public speaking performance, and, by analogy, how drama itself can function as effective propaganda to convert its own audience. While suffrage dramas do employ some melodramatic conventions of the Victorian stage, they also consistently work to move beyond those conventions by revealing them as conventions. Most of Robbins's novel, The Convert, functions as a fictionalized depiction of the suffrage movement's demonstrations in public spaces such as London's Embankment, Hyde Park, and Trafalgar Square. By contrast, the play devotes itself to the personal story of Vida. While the second act's political rally, in which Vida speaks, is overtly theatrical, she also performs a role when she allows Jean to believe that she was crushed by Jeffrey. Vida actively performs a personal drama for political ends because, as she says, voicing the strategy of the play itself, Jean isn't old enough to be able to care as much about a principle as about a person. Vida is not interested in personal vindication, but in political clout. She tells Jean, "Bring Jeffrey to the point where he recognizes that he's in our debt, in debt to women. There are thousands with hope still in their hearts and youth in their blood Let him help them. Let him be a friend to women. Vita's ultimate goal in gaining Jean's loyalty is to use her as a bargaining chip in order to gain Geoffrey's parliamentary vote. Although she refuses Geoffrey's offer of marriage, which he makes at Jean's insistence, Vita blackmails him with the possibility that she can keep Jean from marrying by persuading Jean to devote her entire life to the suffrage movement. Votes for Women argues both for women's entry into public life and for a politically engaged drama, and it moves beyond the domestic, realistic theater of the Victorian period to emphasize the importance of public and political involvement over merely private and personal concerns. The first of Robbins's three acts is set in a country house, the inhabitants of which are preoccupied with the engagement of the heiress Jean to Geoffrey and with observing social proprieties. The society drama enacted in this setting, the discovery of a character's past, had become a theatrical trend with the plays of Arthur Wing Pinero and Oscar Wilde in the last decades of the 19th century. After employing them, Votes for Women proceeds to reject such conventions of society drama by representing the world outside the home. In contrast to the spatially confined and etiquette-bound domestic set of Act One, the Act Two suffrage rally in Trafalgar Square is a set opening into the wings of the stage, an event in which classes and sexes mingle with no concern for the dictates of polite society. The speakers on the plinth of Nelson's Column include men and women who range across classes. And the scene is strikingly evocative of actual suffrage demonstrations. A reviewer for the Academy observed how noteworthy the staging of this scene was, and actually many reviewers observed that this scene stood out as real progress in theater production. So the reviewer of the Academy observed how the staging of the scene elided the distinction between the theater audience and the onstage suffrage rally. The speakers on the stage faced the footlights. The crowd on the stage itself was merely a thin line of supernumeraries facing the speakers and with their backs to the house. Behind the supers was we. We were the real crowd, and it was to us that the speeches from the plinth were addressed. We it was who, sometimes following the stage crowd and sometimes leading it, laughed or cheered or dissented as order after order harangued us on women's rights and women's wrongs. Robbins's third act in Votes for Women returns to an interior, but presents political action in that setting, this time in London rather than a distant aristocratic country environment, as the play points out that that drama focused on individuals must not be disassociated from a broader social context. Moving beyond domestic settings also meant moving beyond the upper middle class denizens of the drawing room drama of Pinero and Wilde. Vita enters into and understands the experiences of women outside of her social class, thereby mediating and facilitating for the theater audience a sympathetic identification between upper middle class women and working class women. Like actresses, Vita is able to cross class lines, and she brings the experience of homeless women and prostitutes into the drawing room when she describes how she put on an old gown and a tawdry hat in order to experience firsthand what she calls the underworld. Vita's speech at the end of the play about what her story can accomplish reflects both her demands that the personal be subordinated to the political and the play's demands that personal drama give way to political drama. One woman's mishap? What is that? A thing as trivial to the great world as it's sordid in most eyes. But the time has come when a woman may look about her and say, what general significance has my secret pain? Does it join on to anything? And I find it does. I'm no longer merely a woman who has stumbled on the way. I'm one who has got up bruised and bleeding, wiped the dust from her hands and the tears from her face, and said to herself, not merely, here's one luckless woman, but here is a stone of stumbling to many. Let's see if it can't be moved out of other women's way. And she calls people to come and help. No moral man, let alone a woman, by herself, can move that rock of offense. But if many help, Geoffrey, the thing can be done. Vida's speech illuminates how Votes for Women self-consciously uses the experience of an individual to represent a broader social cause and convert large numbers of people to that cause. Vida's speech also reveals the power of the play. In using a personal story to attract sympathy for a social cause, both Vida and Robbins embody the assertion that women can participate in and understand the public world.
The militant suffragists who form the Women's Social and Political Union are engaged in the attempt to win the parliamentary vote for the women of this country. Their claim is that those women who pay rates and taxes and fulfill the same qualifications as men voters shall be placed upon the parliamentary register. The reasons why women should have the vote are obvious to every fair-minded person.
After the success of The Convert, Robbins signed a long-term lease on a farmhouse in Henfield, Sussex. She called the house Baxettown, and a few years later she opened it as a rest home for suffragettes who had been in prison. In the 1920s, the house became a rest home for professional women. David Scott, the son of Robbins' housekeeper, became a part of her family, and Octavia Wilberforce, a woman a quarter of a century younger than Robbins, became her primary companion in the last decades of her life. Elizabeth supported Octavia as she studied to become a doctor, and Octavia actually served as doctor to Virginia Woolf. Through World War I, the 1920s and 1930s, and World War II, Robbins continued to write novels and nonfiction, volunteering at the Endell Street Hospital during World War I. She spent the years of World War II in the United States and maintained a transatlantic lifestyle in her last 25 years, dying in England, in Brighton, in 1852. In her long life, she had established homes for herself in the United States and Great Britain, made careers as a performer and writer, and worked to effect political, social, and cultural change.
Nata, that was fascinating. Thank you so much. And the fact that Elizabeth lived for such a long life as well, she must have seen so much change. It's amazing, and what a go-getter mm-hmm. she was.
Right, absolutely. And in many ways, she is an important transitional figure for thinking about the move from the 19th century to the 20th.
So now our podcast, as you know, is called Famous People You've Never Heard Of. So we're trying to get these people out into the public eye a little bit more. So your book is out, hardback and paperback. Mm-hmm. I've got the posh hardback version. It's called The Victorian Actress in the Novel and on the Stage, and that's published by Edinburgh University Press. Are there any other easily come-byable sources that people could find out about Elizabeth with?
Absolutely. To learn much more about Elizabeth Robbins, there are two really excellent biographies of her. One by Angela V. Johns called Elizabeth Robbins, Staging Life, 1862 to 1952, and Joanna E. Gates's Elizabeth Robbins, 1862 to 1952, Actress, Novelist, Feminist. More recently, Naomi Paxton came out with a book in the last couple of years called Stage Rights, The Actresses Franchise League, Activism and Politics, 1908 to 1958, which is also easily accessible in your booksellers.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, I'll put all of that in the program notes, and it looks like I've got a really good Christmas list now. So that will keep me going until next year at least. And one thing that I like to ask everybody on the podcast, which is it's just for my own amusement, really, if we're looking at a fantasy dinner party where, apart from Elizabeth, who obviously is going to be guest of honour, you could invite anybody. Do you have a magic list of people you'd like to get together?
I think I would like to put Elizabeth Robbins in a group of a kind of genealogy of women who worked on women's rights. And so I think I would, in historical sequence, I think I would want to go back in time a bit prior to Elizabeth Robbins and invite Mary Wollstonecraft, author of Vindication of the Rights of Woman in 1792. I would definitely want to include George Eliot, my favorite 19th century novelist, who is also a figure of great importance to women writers who followed after her. Elizabeth Robbins wrote a bit about her in the novel I mentioned, George Mandeville's Husband. in some ways, George Eliot was an inspiration for writers who followed her, but in some ways also a little intimidating as a predecessor. I want to invite the American Frances E.W. Harper, who was a 19th century suffragist and abolitionist. And then moving on into the current day, I would want to invite the contemporary playwright Heidi Schreck, who is the playwright of What the Constitution Means to Me. When I saw that on Broadway, I thought about how it followed on Robbins's Votes for Women in interesting ways because of its focus on the act of women speaking and its use of drama to emphasize concerns about women's bodies. And given the fact that we have just had an election in the United States and we've elected our first woman to serve as vice president, I'd want to invite Kamala Harris, because I think that the women who came before us would be interested in speaking with her and have a lot to share with her. And I think that she would also benefit from the wisdom of women who had struggled before her.
That is a wonderful list. Can I come?
Absolutely. The more the merrier.
Fly them all in. We'll bring them all to London and we'll do it here. I'll host it. That sounds fantastic.
Sounds great.
A little bit of recent controversy as well. Mary Wollstonecraft's statue. Have you seen that?
I have, yes. Mm.
Yes, I won't ask for your opinion because it's too divisive, but it's an interesting take, isn't it? As a statue, I quite like it.
Right. Yes, yes.
Yeah, I think I would have liked to have seen perhaps one next door to it that actually was of Mary Wollstonecraft. But yeah, that's another story. We digress. And hopefully you can come to London and entertain us with some more lectures as soon as we're all allowed out again.
Well, my last lecture was right before the lockdown for COVID. So I returned home and I got on a plane immediately after the talk at the VNA. And I've been pretty much stuck at home since.
Oh my goodness. Thank you very, very much for coming
on. Thank you so much for having me.
My absolute pleasure, and have a wonderful festive season.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Famous People You've Never Heard Of. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find us more easily and you'll never miss an episode. If you'd like to support our work, it's easy to do. Just go to www.patreon.com/bluefiretheatre. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.